Yours is our great fortune of having this precious human life with all of its freedom and fortunes. Having bodies and minds that function well, having all of our physical necessities met, meeting the Buddha's teachings that are present in our world, given to us by qualified Mahayana teachers, having a supportive circle of friends, let's rejoice in that and open our hearts to the Buddha's teachings, making a commitment, an aspiration to integrate them into our lives to the best of our ability, for the long-term goal of freeing ourselves for good from the unsatisfactory conditions of cyclic existence, the cycle of aging, sickness and death, rebirth over and over, for the final goal of our enlightenment, for the sole purpose of benefiting all living beings and bringing them to that same permanent peace. So today we are going to continue the book that we are working with is Taming the Mind, a book that Venerable wrote a few years ago, which is a lovely book, very accessible, about how we live our lives, bring meaning, transform our minds into peace and wisdom, and for the very practical things of having to deal with our aging parents, wild children, difficult colleagues, environment that's changing moment by moment. And so today we're going to spend some time talking about the Noble Eightfold Path. Venerable Tarpa did a lovely sharing last month on the Four Noble Truths, and today we're going to focus on when the Buddha reached enlightenment and saw through the truth of dukkha, our situation here in this world, the causes of it, the fundamental ignorance of perceiving our reality as concrete, independent, permanent, unchanging, and our continual maneuvering, planning, strategizing to find happiness in something that doesn't exist, and his experience of finding the way of liberating ourselves from this cycle of unsatisfactory conditions, and setting up a very beautiful structure that gives us the possibility of attaining exactly what we seek, which is a peace that does not end, for the benefit of not only our own well-being, but also to bring all living beings along with us to that final goal of enlightenment. So, and how that is done in our tradition, it's the fourth noble truth that we're going to be spending time with today. And in our tradition, it's called, as Venerable Jigme put us beautifully through that analytical meditation, the three higher trainings of ethical discipline, concentration, or meditative stabilization or wisdom. However, in a number of the traditions, and Venerable goes through it in nice detail in this book, they're also called the Noble Eightfold Path, and those eight factors are put into the three higher trainings. So we're going to split them up today one by one and see how they work together and relate to one another and build on each other. And we'll be able to have perhaps some more clarity on those three very focused questions that Venerable Jigme put into the meditation, because this is a lot about the Noble Eightfold Path response to those questions very specifically. And I'm going to use an analogy, because we have Gotami House sort of in our mind streams these days. And I'm going to take the three higher trainings and put them into the analogy of building, a nice building that's going to last. So the first of the three eightfold paths is the come under the higher training of ethical discipline. And my analogy is that ethical discipline is like the foundation, the framing, the roof, and the siding of a well-built house. This is what everything else is really going to rest on. And so it is the foundation of any spiritual practice, because it improves the quality of our lives from the get-go. There is a Theravada monastic, a Westerner, Bhikkhu Bodhi, who wrote a book called The Noble Eightfold Path, and I used his book in correlation with a venerable book here. And he states that in this book, the observance of ethic leads to harmony in our lives in four particular ways. Socially, if you can imagine that any family, community, society that live by the principle of ethics, how it would, if not eliminate, subdue all conflict, all wars, all misunderstandings, all miscommunication. So socially, ethical discipline is a fundamental way to find harmony. Psychologically, it brings us a peace of mind, a kind of peace that we can actually sleep at night, knowing that we are practicing right action, right speech, and right livelihood. Karmically, it creates the causes and conditions for us to have future rebirths, where we can continue to cultivate all the virtuous qualities in our mind and subdue all the negative qualities. And then in as far as contemplation, by a practicing ethical discipline, we then get to have a mind that's much more focused, much more clear, and get into these very subtle stages of awareness that we need to actually transform our minds and to develop wisdom. So right off the bat, ethical discipline is a win-win situation, not only for ourselves, but for everybody around us. So the first of the three factors of the Noble Eightfold Path underneath this ethical discipline is right action. And we've seen these teachings, Venerable's given the teachings about how to abandon the 10 non-virtuous actions, how to cultivate the 10 constructive ones. But putting them in the ethical discipline underneath that, for me, going through this gave them much more power, much more importance and significance, because this is where I get to integrate them into my life on a daily basis. So right action covers the three, abandoning the three destructive actions of killing, stealing, and sexual misconduct. So the realization that to abandon intentional killing in any form, not just around other human beings, and this is where we as a family of human beings have got to step up to the plate and bring this virtue of non-killing to a whole nother level. This includes animals and insects. We have a multi-billion dollar industry in this country that gives us the tools and the mechanisms, services, to basically annihilate and eliminate most of the animal and the insect realm. And if we're going to practice this particular right action, we have got to take into effect that every living being, regardless of the size, or it's what it does to us, deserves more than anything to be happy and not suffer. And the animal and the insect realm don't have possessions, status, fame, chocolate cake, beautiful houses. They have these little lives that sometimes last only a few days, sometimes last decade. And that's the only thing that they have. And for us to cultivate right action, we've got to bring them into our lives as something to respect, to take care of, to honor. And so the virtuous counterpart of killing is to have a loving, kind, considerate respect for all living things. To actually protect them, not just to stay out of their way, but as much as we can to protect them. The second of the right actions is to abandon stealing, which is taking things that are not freely given. And this one, because it's not as apparent as, our culture kind of gives us a little bit of an unspoken permission to do this. Sometimes in our places of employment, and especially now with the economic downturn, or if the health insurances are being taken out, the 401s, and sometimes we find a way to justify taking things from the places that we work because we're not getting paid enough, we're not getting the vacations, the retirement that we want. There is this unspoken condoning of taking things that are not given, particularly in our workplaces. The government's taking way too many taxes, so if somebody wants to pay me $300 to clean the house, work on my yard, remodel, $1,000 remodel my house, and they want to pay me cash, I don't have to tell the government about that. So this is a place where we have an opportunity to practice caring for other people's possessions and cultivating the mind of contentment with what we have. That's the counterpart of stealing, is to be content with what we have and honor all, not only our own possessions, but others' possessions. The third one in right action is abandoning sexual misconduct. And this generally refers to adultery, having sexual relationships with others who are in intimate relationships or marriages, or stepping outside of our intimate relationships and having sexual relationships with others. But on a bigger, deeper level is refraining from any type of sexual misconduct that can cause physical, emotional, or mental harm to ourselves and others. And the virtuous counterpart of this is fidelity, faithfulness, staying within the commitment that we've made if we are in intimate relationships with others. So right action brings us into an awareness of how we affect other people. You know, the I want when I want when I want, it gets totally reconsidered when we first think about how our actions affect other beings. And by bringing that up into, before we set into action, our body, our speech, is to think how this is going to affect other people. The second of the factors underneath ethical discipline is right speech. And this is in regards to abandoning lying, slander, harsh speech, or idle talk. Sometimes the effect of speech on others is not apparent as our actions of our body, but this one is extremely slippery. And part of it is, and this includes, and this is what Bhikkhu Bodhi shared and I agree with, is that it also includes the written word. That the power of the written word, as far as lying, slander, harsh speech, and idle talk, is just as crucial. And with our communication and technology that we have, the words that are spoken, the words that are get written, non-virtuous, can be heard and seen throughout the world. They are the cause of conflict, misunderstandings. They create enemies, they break lives. And the virtuous counterparts of these create harmony, they create peace, and they heal divisions. So speech is a very powerful tool as far as cultivating ethical discipline. And so we begin with lying, which is not just a word, but it's a shrug, it's a nod, anything that indicates an intention to deceive. And we know, whether living in a family or a community or a society, that we can only live together well if there's an atmosphere of trust, that what we say is to the best of our ability what we understand to be true. And that with distrust and suspicion, when it becomes widespread, lying by its very nature proliferates. So if you are to say something untrue, you have to cover that yet with another untruth, which then escalates to another untruth. And there goes trust, there goes confidence, the people's wanting to confide in you. I mean, it really does build a lot of distrust and suspicion in the world. And so the counterpart of that is to be as truthful as possible, to keep confidence as well, if they do not harm, and really be as truthful as we can. The second is abandoning divisive speech, which causes people who are struggling to quarrel or causes people to not be able to reconcile. And Bhikkhu Bodhi, he addresses the motivation of slander. And it took me a little bit to think, and when I read what he said, I understand, and it's quite true, is that what motivates us to slander is usually a jealousy of another's successes or virtues. If we are infatuated with someone who's in a relationship that is faltering, that sometimes motivates us to cause even more division in that relationship because we really want one of those two people. And there's a strange glee in the human family of actually seeing friends having difficulty. which is a hard thing to actually admit to, but I can admit to it in certain times in my life, that the jealousy would surmount to wanting things not to succeed in my friend's life, and so to perpetuate a sense of failure in that relationship. Its virtuous counterpart is to bring people together with harmonious speech, which originates in the mind of kindness and empathy. It wins trust and affection of others, who then feel that they can trust you with their deepest heartfelt wishes and aspirations. And the karmic results of harmonious speech are that you are going to have trustworthy friends in the future that are going to care and respect you very much. The next one is harsh speech, which harms and ridicules, humiliates, and insults people. So we want to abandon this. And this can be done with a growl, or this can be done with, as Venerable says, a very sweet, innocent smile on our faces, praising people, it seems, on the surface, when in fact we're demeaning them by putting a little bit of a twist of sarcasm or shame into the process. The counterpart of this is to be tolerant of blame and criticism that comes your way, to be tolerant of other people's shortcomings, and to be open to other people's points of view. And then lastly, as far as right speech goes, abandoning the speech about things that are inconsequential, that have no value, that are meaningless. And I think particularly in the Western world, this is one that we I think have a hard time with. I mean, once again, we have an industry, we have newspapers, we have TV shows that make billions and billions of dollars a year and fill our minds with all the things, particularly the bad things, that are happening to movie stars, sports heroes, political figures. They fill our newsstands, they fill our TV channels with what's going on in all of these people's lives. Now, Venerable is very clear that there are relationships in our lives that the connection is made with our families, our friends, our colleagues. We talk about the weather, how's Uncle Joe doing after his surgery, how are the kids doing in school. I mean, these are part of the way in which we connect with each other. You know, those relationships that are intimate or not so intimate, we make connections talking about things that on the surface don't look very of having any value, but that keeps us connected to our larger society. But we have to be careful, because it so easily slips into the spicy, juicy tidbits about people's lives that you heard from a friend, from a friend, from a friend. And then we get into divisive speech, harsh words. So on one hand, it connects us to the world in a certain way, but we have to be very careful. And so the virtuous counterpart of this is to talk about Dharma, talk about things that directly benefit others. Speaking about other people's good qualities behind their back is a wonderful way to counteract idle speech. And then there are the three destructive actions of mind which we want to abandon: covetousness, maliciousness, and wrong view, that are not generally under right action or right speech, but Venerable says it's very important to cultivate goodwill, once again, being content with what we have, not figuring out how to get something that somebody else has. And to have, to cultivate an honest, if we have questions about the Dharma, is to cultivate a good sense of curiosity. Wrong view is kind of a vigorous skepticism that has a lot of anger and show me and I don't believe you sort of, I don't believe in rebirth, I don't believe in the Buddha Dharma, I don't believe in liberation. It's not that kind of doubt that arises from wanting to know the answer to your questions in a heartfelt way and being open-minded to understanding. It's the kind of wrong view that just likes to disagree and argue just for the sake of arguing and has no intention of wanting to change one's mind. So Venerable, although they're not part of these two, Venerable says we want to cultivate open-heartedness and content and rejoice in others' good fortune. And then the third underneath ethical discipline is right livelihood. And this one also is quite I find this a helpful understanding, is that since we all need to sustain our lives, have roofs over our heads, food on our tables, you know, take care of our families, support our friends, that we need to choose a livelihood that does not harm others. And the apparent ones are, you know, butcher, hunter, manufacturing weapons, chemical warfare, any type of substances that can harm other living things, illegal drugs. Those are the apparent ones. And we're only able to choose the livelihoods that we feel that we can do ethically. We have no control other what members of our family do, what societies, what our countries do. We can only, to the best of our ability, choose a livelihood that will benefit others and not cause harm. There are some circumstances and situations where you live in a small town, the biggest employer is a casino or a prison. That's the way you're going to put food on the table. Do the best you can. You know, come into that livelihood with a sincere motivation not to harm, and do the best you can. And underneath this also, Bhikkhu Bodhi shares, there's a part of the Thai tradition treatise on right livelihood that have three headings titled Rightness Regarding Actions, Rightness Regarding Persons, and Rightness Regarding Objects. And underneath this we've got, and persons and actions seem somewhat similar to me, but they did differentiate them. The first regarding actions is workers need to fulfill their jobs diligently and honestly, conscientiously, not hanging around idly talking, claiming hours that you haven't worked, pocketing the company's goods. So if you're going to work for a company as an employee, to really do it the best you can, as honestly as you can. The rightness of persons is respect and consideration from employers, employees, merchants, customers, that the employee is to actually give their employees jobs that they have the ability and capacity to do well, to pay them adequately for their efforts, to promote them when they can, and to reward them if possible. That the employees in response can work diligently, conscientiously, doing the best they can. To colleagues should cooperate rather than compete. And merchants must be fair in dealing with customers. That's regarding persons. And then the rightness regarding objects is to always represent what you're offering, whether it be a service or goods, as honestly as you can, and to not have any deceptive advertising or misrepresenting the quality or the quantity of what you're offering. So these are the subheadings under right livelihood. So if you kind of take some of these into account when you're looking for work, it'll certainly narrow the field, and it may open up some possibilities that you may not have considered. So that's the first, which is in regards to ethical discipline. The second set of factors are subsumed under the higher training of concentration. And the analogy that I think about here is the plumbing, the heating, the electrical system, the sheetrock, the flooring, the stuff that on the surface you may not be able to see. But if they weren't there, the house wouldn't be usable, wouldn't be livable. So concentration is sort of like that. We're talking about cultivating qualities of the mind that on the surface from the outside people don't know is there. But without it, we cannot have a livable environment. And so the first of these, and concentration is a vital part of the path, because without it we won't be able to focus on a virtuous object for any period of time. And if we're going to cultivate wisdom realizing emptiness, we have to have a mind that is subdued, clear, stable, focused enough to be able to do that as long as we want. So the first factor underneath right concentration is right effort. And this is an important factor along the path. Ethics, wisdom, concentration all contain this, but it's particularly put under the higher training of concentration. And it is the energy involved, a wholesome kind of energy which arises from wholesome states of mind. And once again, Bhikkhu Bodhi explains that the Buddha stressed this quality over and over again in his teachings for 45 years. He used the terms diligence, exertion, and unflagging perseverance, because he realized very clearly that the path to liberation and enlightenment is a long one, and that he could only point the way. He can't do it for us. It is our responsibility to find our way out of the cycle of existence, and that having an unfaltering, unremitting energy for the path is the way to succeed. And that the starting point is our deluded, confused minds, and the goal is liberation and enlightenment, and that space between those two is long and arduous, and without right joyous effort, it's not going to happen. The task is not easy, but the Buddha and 2,600 years of realized practitioners and teachers have verified as living testimonials that it is possible. But it was through this particular quality, the one that His Holiness says, never give up. That's what this is right effort. They are a living proof that if you practice the path without with great perseverance and stamina, you will accomplish the goal. The second of the factors under concentration is right mindfulness, which is a mental factor that enables you to remember the virtuous object that you are focused on. Being mindfulness of the 10 constructive actions, once again, this brings the ethical discipline into a deeper level of understanding. It also helps in meditation because it counteracts the mind, the forgetfulness, laxity, and excitement. So this is the remembering aspect of meditation, continually bringing the mind back to the virtuous object, whether it's the Buddha, loving kindness, ethical discipline, compassion, love, over and over again, remembering the object, come back, come back, come back. And there's another whole explanation of mindfulness in the Theravada tradition, which I didn't get into, which is a lovely piece, but this is what we're going to focus on today. This repeatedly returning our attention to a virtuous object over time brings stability and strength to our meditation. So it sounds very simple, yet it's very difficult, but over time it brings a strength, and it's the stability, the ability to not wander off after every distracted thought that walks by, floats up. The mindfulness keeps you totally focused on your object, remembering it over and over again. And then this right concentration is the single-pointedness on the object of meditation. And this factor arises slowly through right effort and right mindfulness. Concentration in and of itself is something that Buddhists and non-Buddhists do. This is something that any focused mind, whether it be a potter throwing a wheel, a sniper, a scientist in a lab trying to put together a complicated theory, you know, that is all very focused, undivided attention with all the sense consciousnesses are just, you're not hearing anything. You're so focused on the object. But in this particular, in the Buddhist tradition, you want to be this is the state that we want, but we also want to have a deliberate attempt to raise the mind to a very subtle, pure level of bare attention. And this is sustained by virtuous thoughts of refuge, the determination to be free, bodhicitta. These are all sort of the food of this particular one-pointedness. The motivation behind this sustains this level of concentration. Because many non-Buddhists find this place, apparently, is that these deep, single-pointed levels of concentration with a very subtle mind generates an extreme level of bliss in the mind. Something that they say is not even comparable in the world of the senses. We want to get to that, but that's not the goal. The goal is to use that subtle level of single-pointed concentration to realize the wisdom, the ultimate, deeper mode of existence. So we can get to that place, but then we go farther. Because we want to realize the emptiness to attain liberation and enlightenment. So these are the factors involved, the level of concentration we need to get to transform our minds and to realize emptiness directly. The mind's got to be refined, stable, focused, subtle, free of any distractive thoughts for long, long periods of time. And then finally, the last two factors, which are right intention or thought and then right view, are subsumed under the higher training of wisdom. And the analogy that I continue with is that the wisdom is the windows and the doors. Mm-hmm. the ones that open up to the moonlight, the sunlight, the fresh air, with a panoramic view of all things. So we are living ethically, which eliminates the non-virtuous actions, the distractive, discursive thoughts. Concentration subdues those afflicted states of mind. But without wisdom, there is no way to liberate ourselves from this continued rebirth and cyclic existence. So this, to eliminate the cause of all the dukkha, the ignorance, the fundamental misunderstanding of how things really exist, we have to realize the emptiness of inherent existence of ourself and all phenomena, how things really exist. To do this, we have to practice special insight, which we also call vipassana, which is the discriminating wisdom that arises through these deep analysis of the mode of existence. So we've got these beautiful, profound analytical meditations in the long rim around emptiness and dependent arising. So the piercing study, understanding, contemplation of how things exist by understanding the emptiness of inherent existence of the self, the dependent arising of all phenomena in the self, the wisdom that arises from understanding that intellectually, inferentially, that's the vipassana, the special insight, is one of the pieces in the wisdom practice. The other one then is the shamatha, which is through this deep concentration, we get into this subtle states of mind. But until we realize emptiness, those two things don't live together. The analysis, the deep analysis, brings us to a level of understanding, but we can't tie that. It disturbs the level of concentration, because one's on this very deep conceptual level, and then one is of more the direct experience inside the mind. So these two things we learn sort of simultaneously, but they don't go together. It's one or the other. And then when you get to the point where those two conjoin, the deep piercing understanding of how things are inferentially, with a mind that is stable, focused, subdued, when they conjoin together, that's where this direct perception of emptiness arises. And this is my understanding of what I read, and because I have no even intellectual understanding of either of these two things, I basically took it right out of the book. So it says that to do this, we practice special insight, which is a discriminating wisdom that joins the pliancy and stability achieved through concentration induced by the power of that analysis. Until we attain vipassana, this powerful discriminating wisdom, whenever we do analytical meditation, our concentration is disturbed. We've got to do this thinking, this understanding, and this deep level of awareness. They don't reside together in the beginning. But what it does is that this vipassana makes the mind very powerful as far as the level of understanding. When this powerful state of mind is concentrated on looking at the emptiness of inherent existence of the self, it then cleanses our mind streams of not only the ignorance, this misperception, as well as all the afflictions, the karma, and the imprints that follow. So my understanding is that because we talk about this inference of understanding emptiness, but it's still on the intellectual, deeply intellectual level of the mind. And then there's the state of the mind itself that can stay on a virtuous object, focused, a very subtle level. And somewhere along the line, those two interconnect. And that's where the direct perception of emptiness arises. Someday. So the right viewer understanding is the understanding of the Four Noble Truths. It's the wisdom that opposes the deluded views, such as the concept of inherent existence and the grasping at a solid I. The body and mind as being solid, existing independently from its own side. So right view is understanding that this is not true, opposes the deluded view. And then the right thought or intention. There are three explanations under this. There's a factor of non-attachment or renunciation, benevolence or goodwill, and non-harmlessness. So when the thoughts are wholesome or the intention right, the actions will be right. So this is very important when we want to generate the right view. We've got to have these three factors involved in our intention. And I would put in probably the deep intention of bodhicitta. On a deeper level, right thought refers to the mind that subtly analyzes emptiness, which in turn leads us to perceive it directly. There's a whole, and Venerable in the book, she says, I'm going to talk about this later in the book. So she was very general in these, in the wisdom training in this chapter. So by taking care of our bodies, watching our speech, and training our minds, we can practice the Noble Eightfold Path. And it's called noble because those who have practiced these eight factors have achieved liberation and enlightenment and called Arya beings who have perceived emptiness directly. So the noble and the Four Noble Truths and the noble and the Noble Eightfold Path refer to the minds of these Arya beings who have taken each and every one of these eight factors, have lived them, integrated them into their lives, and realized them completely in their mind streams. This is like, for the first time, I've seen it just so beautifully laid out as a systematic, organic structure. I'd always wondered how the Noble Eightfold Path had anything to do with the three higher trainings. Now I know. And the Buddha said that practicing the Noble Eightfold Path will give rise to vision, gives rise to knowledge, leads to peace, direct knowledge, to enlightenment, and to nirvana. So he has signed on the dotted line and said that if you follow the Noble Eightfold Path and integrate it into your life, I can guarantee, assure you, unequivocally, that you will attain liberation and enlightenment. I did want to just share something that Venerable has said a number of times, is that when I first heard the Four Noble Truths, I was like, you know, I'm not sure about this Dharma because it talks all about this suffering stuff. You know, it's so pessimistic. It's so like, oh yeah, life is suffering, death is suffering, rebirth is suffering. But she remembers that even when she was a little girl, she had these questions, and I had my niece ask these questions of me one time too. Like, what is the meaning of life? Why are we here? You know, what is this all about? And so being raised in a world that said, well, you get married, you have a family, you buy a house, you buy a car, you get status, fame, reputation. And through Venerable, her story is that, you know, she kind of went through that and she didn't get the answer to her questions. And so when she first heard the teachings on the Four Noble Truths, and I don't know, when she saw that flyer, went to that meditation course, whether it was Lama Yeshe or Lama Zopa, when they talked about the Four Noble Truths, and it says a lot about Venerable, she experienced a deep sense of relief because she finally said somebody was telling her the truth. Because her experience in her life was that happiness was not about having a car, getting married, having a job, a profession, an education. There was something deeper that she was missing. And that life was just unsatisfactory. So to have this Tibet Lama come in and say, that's right, child, dear, is that life is dissatisfaction. But there's a way, and there is a teaching in this world that validates, says that's true, and that there's a way out of it. And I think that's where the whole karma of her life with the Dharma, from that teaching. And so I have been able to turn my mind over the past, particularly the past 5 years, from seeing the Four Noble Truths as one of the most liberating, life-affirming, empowering teachings of the Buddha. And why he stepped into the world with that teaching the first thing that ever came out of his mouth was the Four Noble Truths, and how empowering and how liberating it is. So, and that the Noble Eightfold Path is that is the way in which we achieve liberation and enlightenment. So I have found this particular sharing of this today very inspiring for my own practice, and has brought the Four Noble Truths into like my top teaching to integrate into my life. So does anybody have any questions or comments about this teaching that I might be able to, I don't know, any comments?
I have a question. About that very last thing, that on the deeper level, the very intent is the mind that analyzes
thinking. Mm-hmm.
How is that then different from right view? How does that fall under there?
You know, I have the same question.
Okay.
I mean, I took this, and then Venerable says this will be discussed more in depth in the section on wisdom. But I don't know the answer to that question. Why right view isn't the higher training of wisdom in and of itself?
Yeah.
And also I had somewhat the same questions when we got into right concentration. Mm-hmm. As a higher training, that it has these three subheadings. You can see how they build on one another, but yet there's a similarity in there. I just don't have the ability to see the differentiation between the right concentration as the Noble Eightfold Path factor and the higher training, how they're different, what the subtleties of them are. So I would very much like to ask them.
You made a comment toward the end about defining the word noble. You used the words liberation and enlightenment. My understanding is that's not correct, that noble is an Arya being and not an enlightened being.
Yes, thank you. It's the mind that realizes emptiness directly. Enlightenment is another whole thing. Yes.
I think they use that word differently in the traditions. I think in the Pali they'll use the word enlightenment for nirvana.
Nirvana,
yes.
Mm-hmm. Which they do.
Which we would not. We'd make quite a distinction between the nirvana, liberation, and then the full enlightenment.
Mm-hmm.
So they actually, you see that word
differently.
Yeah, in the different conditions, so it's kind of confusing.
And wouldn't the Buddha be referred to as a noble one?
Yeah, he is.
Right, but he's also enlightened.
Yeah.
Thank you, Kevin. Yeah.
On the ethics stuff, I had a pretty big internal struggle when Venerable first talked about the piece you brought up again today about not stealing by not paying all of your taxes. Because when I came to the Dharma, I came out of left field politics and was pretty active in war tax resistance. And the government, of course, uses, X percentage of the wage war. So around that time, I was kind of taking X percentage, out and giving it to nonprofits or using it for my own family, saying this is a better use of it. So I talked with her about it. And it's still a little gray to me, but here's what she said, and so this is what I did then after I met her, and for the next 7 years or whatever, when I had an income like that with self-employment where, you could do those kind of things. She said, pay all the taxes because that's what other people are doing, and then when you take from, the big pool of citizens is who you're kind of taking from. Because they're all paying their share. And then what you do is you put a letter into every time you send your taxes in that says, it is my intention that none of this is used to harm anyone, to wage war, to whatever. And so I did that, and it felt a lot better. But every time that issue comes up, I still go through that struggle about giving the money just over to a government that does some good things, roads and hospitals, education, but some really horrific. So I do what she said because she's my teacher and I know she's got clean, clear thoughts about it, but I still have this
Well, that's why when she puts that, I think that's where she puts the little addendum here, is that now we are only able to choose for our own lives. We cannot control what other people or countries do.
Yeah.
So once again, it's to have other people's harmful actions affect us to where we create non-virtue. I mean, on the level that I am at, I'm more closer to home. I would love to be able to control what my country does, but I think
yeah.
that's where she puts just a clarification. But
yeah,
it's
like staying in your own
square
and keeping your own stuff wiki
clean.
Mm-hmm. So it did feel better than what, because what I was doing before also brought some stress and anxiety, like what if they audit me and da 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 da. So that was not so good.
Mm-hmm.
I could see, you know, it was more clean, clear.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and I've also seen
very
that. I knew some people in my life that also did the same thing, but the mind that arose in discussion with them was a mind that had a lot of hostility and a lot of anger and a lot of judgment too. So, you know, to be squeaky clean, if you're going to do that, is to have a mind that's very respectful and very, you know, understanding that you're making a choice that's your own.
I was just going to observe that the Atomic Quakers make an observation that conscription now is beyond, because military service is voluntary. At the time of conscription, they believed that taxation was a form of conscription, and many of them chose to earn no more than the level at which you would be taxed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which I think in our government is like $600 a year or something.
It's
pitiful.
$14,000?
Oh, okay.
How do you define ethics?
It's for me?
Yeah, for you, for both. For I have a lot of ways of following ethics, but
mm-hmm.
not really a very clear definition or explanation of what it actually is.
It's what anything that leads
to suffering
is
would be unethical.
Exactly what the meaning of the word ethics means, mm-hmm. not what good ethics are.
Oh,
is that mm-hmm. the definition?
Well, see, I don't know what the dictionary. For me, it's practicing things that bring happiness to myself and others. I mean, that's, but it's more like an activity. It's not a way of thinking. I don't know what the dictionary meaning is actually.
That would work very well in the world. There's a lot of people that are pursuing happiness and aren't very ethical. I mean, kind of what's your definition of happiness with you?
But the happiness is quite limited, and yeah. Well, that's why I think the right action, the right speech, and the right livelihood are the guidelines for what ethics actually is. I mean, if I'm to garner my speech in the exact way that the Buddha said, and to garner my actions the way in which he does in my livelihood, I believe that that is ethics. So it's more of a guideline. Yeah, I'm not even thinking about a state of mind. More of an activity.
Yes, we have the activities laid out for us, but it's kind of like a little too clean, and it's hard to apply that in different situations that might not necessarily fall directly into that.
Mm-hmm.
To be able to apply ethical discipline in that situation, you have to have a clear understanding of just what ethical discipline is without, you know, kind of separating. Of course, the guidelines help you to adapt that to
mm-hmm.
your situation.
Mm-hmm.
Think, well, I know that in such and such situation, this is unethical, so I can kind of transpose that into this situation
mm-hmm.
and understand that this is unethical. So they're good in that way, but I'm just thinking of,
but see, I think that's why the trainings of concentration and wisdom have got to be their components all of each other, because in some situations, unless I had a certain level of clarity in my mind and a certain understanding of, it's like I can't be ethical with having some other qualities and components of the other two trainings involved.
Yeah,
like the discriminating
wisdom. The situation,
But still, at some point in your mind, you have to make a decision on what you, how you're going to turn your mind.
Mm-hmm.
And you should do that based on ethics, hopefully, if it's an ethical situation, even if it's an extremely subtle one.
Mm-hmm.
And in that situation, I guess, I mean, if you do it based on wisdom, if you have wisdom, then that would be okay. But we don't all have wisdom.
Yeah.
Because, so, you know, I mean,
because even in the situation of right speech, Venerable said that there were situations in which telling the truth could harm somebody. Let's say if some, you know, there was a woman who came to you and was looking for protection from or a partner was looking for protection from a violent spouse. They came to the door. You would have to somehow be able to not tell the truth for the benefit and the safety of that person. So it's almost like you're saying, the situation brings up a choice that has to be made to the best of your ability, trying to cause the least amount of harm. But I mean, it's
no,
not a black and white situation.
No. I'm just meaning a definition would be helpful to apply. So not harmfulness sounds more like,
that's as close as,
I mean, that sounds like something that you can apply pretty widely.
Well, those are
the
three practices of Mahayana. Of ethical discipline in the Mahayana are not to harm, to benefit others,
and to accumulate
virtue. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty clear.
Yeah, that's
I mean,
more general.
Yeah, it's more general, the direction is quite clear.
I think of ethics when I think of them being defined as how we relate socially as our interacting with others. So all the things of ethics involve what I would think would be the greater good for individuals, so not just personally, but I mean, you have ethics, you say act ethically in terms of, you know, society.
Socially, psychologically, karmically,
mm-hmm.
meditation.
When I think of that definition, it comes back to, it's there to kind of regulate our behavior, but in a way that we would want it to be for the greater good.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, not only personally, but that it's a mutual kind of thing for me, the other person, for the family, for
society.
You know, yeah, because you could think at some point it might be more ethical not to do your meditation.
Right.
So you could say your meditation is quite important, but there's someone who's in great need,
mm-hmm.
and they can very much benefit from you acting or something.
Mm-hmm.
So,
this line talks about, he talks quite a bit about the difference between those things that are generally ethical. He talks about, he often talks about things that, you know, everyone would consider unethical, regardless of your spiritual background, the things that everyone would consider
naturally good. Negative.
Naturally, and then he talks about those things that are, but he talks about bringing to that, you know, your particular Buddhist perspective. And I've heard him talk a number of times, so he'll start out and saying, you know, everybody believes that, you know, honey is wrong. And that's not necessarily a Buddhist idea, it's just a good idea. And then he'll want to talk about how you apply a Buddhist mind to that idea, and how you, you know, how you deepen it, your spirituality. And so so I think, you know, that's the kind of thing, you know, when we talk about ethics, everybody has the rule of conduct of some kind. And their ethics, you know, their ethics are based on their mind, what kind of mind they have. I mean, even people who are drug dealers have an ethic.
Savvy business practices, not Buddhist ethics.
And there are consequences to following or not following it. So, you know, when we talk about, you know, so I think the good thing is exactly how we explain here. You know, these are absolutely intertwined. You know, it's nice to speak of, you know, sense of focus, like spotlighting certain aspects of it, but obviously all
the way,
and so it's natural for us to say, well, then how is this different than that? You know, how is this spotlight a little different than that? Right? That's really what we're talking about. You know, we're trying to get the subtleties.
Mm-hmm.
We can't
kind of divorce it from the part of the wisdom that has to do with the wisdom related to karma.
Suffering, what leads to happiness.
That happens in the parts of karma that relate to intention. Mm-hmm. So that to me ties the whole thing together.
Mm-hmm. Which
goes to this list there?
Yeah. Okay. Under ethical discipline, there is right action, right speech, and right livelihood. Under concentration, there's right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. And under wisdom, there's right intention or thought and right view. I should write view first and then right intention or thought. These are in slightly different order in different traditions. Intention and thought being synonymous, yes. Mm-hmm. And then right view or understanding. This was a really, now I'm curious, I want to know more about the subtler aspects. And, anyway, so thank you for your questions and your comments, corrections. And so let's just spend a minute or two thinking about whatever struck home or aroused some curiosity or wanting to know more or rejoicing. Once again, remembering that as many of our tantras, the Buddha's up in the corner there and he's pointing at the moon. That he is the guide. That we ourselves are responsible for our own liberation and enlightenment. And throughout it, because of his great compassion, he laid it out in some clear, profound ways. And we have access to that today and rejoice at that. And to see how these Noble Eightfold Path very much benefit others. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the enlightened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forever.